So welcome, last day of Tech Ed in the morning. You're all here. It's a good number here. Thank you. Thank you for attending. Microsoft. We're going to talk about Microsoft Lync Server 2010. We're going to talk about server and client virtualization. My name is Campbell Gunn. I'm a senior program manager within Microsoft, within the Lync Server group. I actually look after virtualization, the actual setup and deployment, topology builder, the planning wizard, the capacity planning tools, those sort of things. That's my area there. So I know the MSIs really, really well. Believe me, I see them on a daily basis. And I also have my colleague here, Tarek.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tarek. I'm a senior program manager in the Lync partner and customer engineering group and office. And I work with partners across the globe to together we enable different scenarios and human interactivity that touch and move and inspire you guys. So, go ahead.
Okay, so here are our session objectives. Very, very simple. First one is we're going to look at how to configure Lync Server 2010 in a virtualized environment. I'm essentially going to give you some, like a blueprint, some ideas, some things that we did in our own lab within the product group to sort of say, well, why did we take it that particular way? We're also going to look at the supported VDI configurations of the Lync client, 2010 client. And lastly, we're going to just talk about some of the limitations of the client and server virtualizations, some things that you need to be conscious of. Just curiosity, how many people are virtualizing OCS? Okay, interesting. All right, I'm going to talk a little bit about that and then some of the differences between sort of historically where we've come from OCS virtualized to where we are today in Lync Server 2010 virtualization. So we've got some takeaways here. We're going to understand the scenarios. We're going to talk about some high-level scenarios, and they are really just like a reference scenario. They're not like take it for gospel, that's what I'm going to go back and put in my own organization. Right? Please don't do that. This is just to give you an idea of what we did in the product groups to understand the different sizing characteristics when we're virtualizing. And again, I'll talk about some specific things. Some of them you may know already, some of them may be new to you. Understand the performance impacts of the Lync Server 2010 virtualization. Some important aspects of that when you do start thinking. Certainly your what we call default profile, that is what type of modalities you're going to use, what type of workloads you're going to put on. If you're just using IM and presence versus video, voice and video, what are some of the things I need to be thinking about with that? And then lastly there, we're going to identify, or you're going to have a takeaway where you're identifying the supported Lync Server 2010, supported Lync 2010 VDI configurations and the limitations. So let's get started. So why virtualize? Why do we want to virtualize? Well, there's two main areas there. We want to reduce TCO, total cost of ownership. We also want to increase operational efficiency. Most likely, some of you are already running virtualization for other reasons, and you're saying, okay, now I want to bring Lync into my virtualized environment and utilize it. Some people also look at data center space. All right, now I've exhausted all my capacity in the data center, and we're now starting to see a lot of consolidation. They're saying, okay, let's, in fact, reduce my hardware footprint within the data center, okay, and I want to load up on a particular host. You start upgrading hardware, and you start actually now starting to load up the amount of machines that you can get per physical hardware. Other things as well is time to deploy. So if you need to spin up another front end and you quickly want to do so for capacity reasons, you can do so quite easily. Other things that we can see here, increase operational flexibility. One of the things that when I talk to customers is the operations or their administration people ratio to how many servers they're going to support and look after, and they look at that ratio and they say, what's that cost associated in managing the ratio of physical hardware to admin or operations? Other things really is just to leverage existing hardware, existing virtualization hardware that you have out there. I want to leverage that with the Lync environment. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that and give you that. So let's now talk about some specific aspects of our Lync Server 2010 virtualization. First one is both the guest and the host required is Microsoft Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1. All right, it's very significant around SP1 and some of the fixes, not so much on the Lync side, but obviously on the Windows side, to be able to, with Hyper-V host. Other virtualization solutions are supported. What we have is the SVVP program, which is the Windows Server Virtualization Validation Program. So things like VMware, Red Hat, Aride Virtualization, any of the Xen, any of the other virtualization solutions out there. Let's talk about Office Communications Server 2007 R2. Probably the important one is that initially back then when we did virtualization, virtualization was fairly new, so we only really concentrated on two aspects, two workloads. So IAM and presence were the two areas that we concentrated on for virtualization. And back then, and it's quite interesting because I've had a few people during the course of TechEd come up to me and with some confusion, and I want to sort of debunk that confusion. And I think it stems around here. And that was when you were virtualizing Office Community or OCS 2007, R2, it was an all or nothing proposition. You either virtualized everything or you didn't. There wasn't an option, right? So you either virtualized or you didn't. And in Link Server 2010, that's not the case, and I'll talk about that very shortly. So I just want to debunk that myth. I had a few people come up to me during this week and say, explain this to me. And I'm like, where did you see that? Look, it's in the white paper as well. We tested it. So it's an interesting one. Link Server 2010 has more extensive workload support. In fact, all of the workloads you'll see very shortly. The only one is the Survival Branch Appliance. You'll see that all of our workloads support virtualization. That was one of the big things that we did in our test matrix within the product group. And also, too, what's significant that we understood when you're virtualizing your Link Server 2010 deployment is you start off very small. You start off with a pilot, 500 to 1,000 users or so, and then you start slowly as the adoption grows and your senior management and people within, high-profile people, start using it. They're saying, hey, we want more, we want more, we want more. Yeah? And you guys are scrambling because they want it yesterday and things like that. And so one of the important parts here is being able to grow from a small site to a very, very large site and being able to have virtualization adopt and grow with that. I mentioned this before, I'll say it again, that the Survival Branch appliance is not virtualized. In fact, it is virtualized in its own right inside the Survival Branch appliance, so hence that point. So let's talk about the different workloads here. So we go down here. It's pretty straightforward. We have all of our server roles here, what is able to be virtualized, and then we also have, in fact, what features are in the virtualized site that we're providing. Again, Survival Branch Office Appliance, though Survival Branch Office Server, the non-OEM server, is able to virtualize for registration enterprise voice. Certainly if you need the resiliency mode and things like that, if you lose your connectivity to your main site, you've still got, and that can be virtualized and sitting as a standalone out at your branch office. So let's talk a little bit about functionality. Deployments will also integrate with Exchange Server 2010, so following Exchange Server's virtualization white paper, virtualizing Exchange as well. Having both Link Server and Exchange virtualized, you still get your unified messaging connectivity between two products. That's still the same. One thing that just Windows Server 2008, not R2, all right, SP1, Hyper-V is not supported. All right, not supported means we haven't tested it, so not supported. Windows Server 2008 SP2 is not supported as the guest OS. That's another thing to be conscious about, what your guest OS is. And that also applies in some respects for 2003. Windows Server 2003, I've had customers coming, can I put that in? No. Okay, just want to stress that one. So let's look at the Link Server 2010 deployment. Again, some general considerations here. This is the big one. This is the one that I still perplexes me today, why people get confused about this. And I think it stems back again with the OCS. And that is that mixed virtual and physical servers within the same pool is not supported. So I've got a front-end pool, I've got 8 servers in my front-end pool, all right, I can't mix that. I can't have 4 that's physical and 4 that's virtual. All right, at the pool level, I can virtualize, and I can virtualize everything, so I can have my edge servers virtualized, non-domain joined, sitting out there in a virtualized on a host. Typically, you want to have them contained within that space. You don't want to have other roles in there as well for obvious reasons. It's out in your DMZ. And then you may have your mediation servers as a pool. You may have your directors as a pool. Okay, that's fine. Also, my back end. I can have my back end in my user pool because concentrating on both the front end and the back end is the user pool. I can have all of that virtualized. I may want to mix, and I get this asked a lot, where my back end, my SQL Server installation, because it's on Windows clustered environment, I want that physical. There may be some reasons behind that. There may be other things that are running on that, and I'll get to a point on that one as well. So that's fine to have that physical and your front end virtual. Or you have a mediation or a conferencing pool or mediation pool that, because you've got a large amount of users, we now support up, originally it was 250, now we support 1,000, you may want to have that on a physical pool for obvious reasons, okay, fairly intensive in your conferencing and your and audio and video. One really important part, and this one comes across because I sort of reach out working on the edges and set up, and that's that second or third point that you can see on the slide, is Link Server 2010 does not provide automatic load balancing. So generally, hardware load balancer, you've got for your HTTP, HTTPS traffic, you may want to use DNS round robin, you may want to use all of your hardware load balancer to do everything, all right? That's entirely up to you. But we don't do that at the application stack. That you've got to have that as forward-facing to provide you with the load balancing capabilities. Balance end-to-end performance is required. This is something that you're going to not wake up in the morning and say, look, I might do a 1,000 user deployment today. Why not? Okay? And now I'm hearing a few laughs and, yeah, sure. All right? We're going to start off with a pilot. We're going to test what our traffic utilization, the bandwidth across, you know, from the back end all the way out to the edge and then all the way back. Okay? Have your clients out there and test that. There is obviously the white paper that gives you, and I'm going to show you some details about that, thinking about from a capacity, a bandwidth perspective. There are also synthetic load tools to ensure there are no bottlenecks. We also have the planning and capacity spreadsheets. So they allow you then to think about, okay, and there's also the planning tool to think about virtualization, the type of workloads you're going to use, how many users you're going to use. I do want to talk about those tools because it's an interesting part. I had somebody come up to me this week and ask me about the planning tool. When you go to the planning tool, it asks you questions, you know, and it's sort of the next type wizard type thing. But it says, are you using a virtualized or are you using physical? And then when you say virtualize, it assumes that you're going to virtualize everything. It doesn't make a differentiation to say, oh, you want a mixed environment, you want physical and virtual. It doesn't do that. So think about that. You know, run through the virtual and think about, all right, what's my load going to be? What modalities? How many users? What type of front ends I'm going to have? How many front ends, etc. And then run through the physical as well and combine the two together. All right, just to caution on the tools that we either do one or the other, and some customers I've had want to mix, and you can do that. This is probably a no-brainer, but I will highlight it, and that's spreading Link Server 2010 workloads on different VM hosts. Okay, your single point of failure when you're running your guests is that physical VM host. That VM host goes down, the physical part of it, you've lost all your guests. And so I have a lot of customers, what they do is they have three or four, I have in more, hosts, and what they do is then they stripe their guests across those physical hosts. So, for example, if you had a front-end user pool, that actually have a guest of a front-end role on each of the hosts. All right, so they're striping across. Think of it's like, you know, hardware raid. It's sort of this, you know, Link Server virtualization raid, all right? Because that's, remember, your pool is that unit to give you that capacity, that high availability. If one of the front ends fails, then you can obviously go, and you've got the others there as well. So think about that one, so you want to stripe that. You may want to do that for your mediation servers, your directors, to give you that prevent that single point of failure. All right. So, yeah, general considerations for a high availability through virtualization. All right, virtualization is not a replacement to your HA solution, all right? You need to think about your HA solution and what you've got there. So many customers going, well, you give me the pool, I can just do that. I've got high availability. Well, yes and no, all right? You still need to have something on you. Remember that Link Server is very database dependent. Your back end, we also have, in fact, user stores sitting on the front ends. It's very data. In fact, there's SQL installed everywhere when you install Link. All right, so think about how I'm going to maintain that, especially if you've got presence information that's storing on the front ends and the time it takes to sync and do UR and sync up. All right, if you've got, and I've seen some of the things in our lab, where you've got close to 300, 400, 500,000 users, it can take anywhere up to 4 hours, 5 hours to sync up through Active Directory Sync and through UR Sync onto those front ends. And then obviously once they're all up to date, when the first one says up to date, then they start slowly populating and getting everything into sync. But that takes time, all right? So think about that. I've actually heard customers where they take the user store, the front RDC local, and they actually spin that instance out and copy everything. And then if they're doing any work, then they spin it back in. As long as it's not doing any schema changes or anything like that, you're fine. All right, it's a quick way to keep the sync up. Implementing pools, obviously, is our way of giving you that high availability, having that pool capability. Also, cluster the SQL backend. Let's talk about that one, because this one's a really interesting one. So in the white paper, we say you should have a dedicated SQL cluster, yeah? And everyone goes, what? I've already spent all this money on a cluster for other things, and now you're telling me I need another cluster? Well, that's our preferred from a supported point of view, all right? If something goes wrong and obviously product support services or any consultants or anyone needs to come in, and we obviously want it on a dedicated so we understand what's going on there. However, if you do some analysis, all right, in your pilot, have a look at what other workloads are going to be on there, and actually do some baselining and understand that what the issues are when you do have to fail over from your active to your passive in your cluster environment and what the load effects are that are happening on that, then you can share it. All right? Not recommended, all right? Not necessarily supported because we don't know your environment. We haven't tested for that. You could obviously, we don't know what your applications are doing. Some people bring legacy applications, other things over. I mean, but I just want to clarify that one. You need to obviously baseline it, understand what's going on in your clustered environment before you start putting Link on top. Some more general considerations. This one is probably the most talked about subject, live migration. And we've also got the live migration and the quick migration. And I put two main reasons why. All right, because of the stateful nature of Link, right, voice and video, conferencing, and IMP, to do just a quick, I'm going to grab that and stick that over there and everything should work. No, all right, they've got permanent connections or stateful connections that they're establishing. And the minute you try and do anything like that, you break all of that. All right, conferencing is the biggest offender. If you try and say, oh, I'm just going to live migrate, you've got to bring all the conferencing material over at the same time, and how do you know it's going to be in sync, and then you start hitting into issues there. The client will try and reconnect. IMP, it generally reconnects from the client perspective, but conferencing, it has a hard time. You actually have to exit the conference, come back into the conference, and then you're not guaranteed. And plus, we just found it just causes significant issues because we're actually managing at the application level all the connectivity access, all the balancing aspects of the client to server. The minute you start jumping in and using live migration or the quick migration, you start interfering with that. Considerations for migrating to Link Server 2010 workloads. So obviously on your front-end servers, we have a concept called draining. And what happens when you go into a draining mode? Obviously, you want to say, okay, how can I do this as seamless as possible? Certainly with Link Server 2010, look at only doing half your pool and doing the drain and then do the other drain so you're not disrupting it. And the flip, if you're doing an upgrade or something like that, or you're starting to bring those front ends across into the virtualization, into the guest. There was someone that mentioned to me this week, which was interesting, where instead of draining at a predetermined time, a graceful time, it decided to just cut there and then. When you said stop, it stopped and disconnected everybody. So at the commandlet level, there is a stop CS Windows Services dash graceful, and you can set a time. Generally, in the product, we set it to about an hour. The one that will hold open connections while you're trying to drain is conferencing, all right? Because they'll sit in there, and you may have two or three people in a conference, and they may have just left, but they're still hanging onto a connection. So you might have issues with that. So just be conscious of that one. Backend. So the minute you take your backend down, obviously your front-end server is going to switch to resiliency mode. So you'll be able to get a dial tone. You'll be able to communicate with through your PSTN gateway or through your SIP trunk, etc. But you won't see presence. Your presence will all go unknown and everything, and you won't be able to do IMP, etc. So just be conscious of that when you're doing your backend. Dynamic memory is currently not supported. Not supported. Let's talk a little bit about that. If you install Service Pack 1, right, you'll see that dynamic memory is working. What does it mean by not supported? Like I said earlier, we haven't tested it. I looked at the various APIs. I saw that we were utilizing them. And when I actually did it in a test environment, a lab, my own lab, I saw that it was picking up and using dynamic memory. Again, you need to test it. You need to test it. All right? But we don't support it. What that means from an official perspective, we didn't test it in our mainstream scenarios, things like that in our labs. But I just wanted to highlight that one. That's typical VM host hardware, and you all look at this and go, yep, hardware's changing, Moore's law, all the time. But this gives you an idea of sort of like a baseline that we used in our lab. You notice that probably the interesting one is the processors, two sockets or more, all right, you want to get that utilization of the vCores. Network adapter, that's probably the most interesting one. 1 gigabit Ethernet versus 10 gigabit Ethernet. It's really how much can you afford, because it's a very controversial one on the actual network side. It's expensive, all right? You get a 10 gigabit Ethernet, it starts to get a little bit expensive. You may want to use your VMQ drivers. Both Broadcom and Intel support the VMQ standard. One important part is make sure that you keep your VMQ drivers up to date. I'll talk more about that very shortly. That's one area that I find people start getting into issues, and they're saying, what's going on here? Okay, well, can you have a look at this for me? And I look and go, well, your VMQ drivers are a little bit out of date here. I would suggest you update them. Obviously, and from a storage perspective, if you can go DAS or you can go SSD, then certainly do that. I'm seeing a lot of customers now starting to go SSD on the front ends, all right, just to get that better performance. Typically, on the conferencing mediation servers back end, they're staying with mechanical. Again, that's entirely up to you. Memory-wise, this is at the host level, all right, and I'll talk about at the guest sort of how much memory you want to get on that. On the host level of 32 gig, host, realistically, you want a lot more than that, but this does give you some idea. So let's talk about the guest guidance here, configuration guidance. First one is if anyone's been running Hyper-V, not just for Link, but for other workloads, other applications, all right, running the application in the VM host root OS is not supported. Obvious reasons, you'll have contention issues. The host is trying to use that partition for its own work and its own capabilities, and now you're putting an application in there, and there's going to be competing resources on that. This next knowledge base article is about your virus scanning, so make sure that you're not going in and virus scanning your guests. Make sure that it's also got a list of the areas within the Hyper-V host of not to scan as well, things like that. So just be conscious of that one. So just some best results for performance here to take note of. The virtual disk has to reside on the dedicated physical disks. I'm going to show you some diagrams shortly about this. You also want to dedicate the host to its own disk as well. Just move the host away from Link Server and have Link Server contained. Other things, too, is that when you're using a SAN, whether that be fiber, whether that be SCSI, to actually dedicate the logical unit along to that as well. That's probably another important part. So here's some basic sort of rule of thumb guest sizing recommendations. So you can see here for the guest, I mean, I'm just going to have a lot more disk. Hopefully going to have a lot more disk space than what I'm showing you here. So you can see the guest VMOS with Link Server, the SQL Server storage drives, and then the file storage. All right, let's get into the ones that I find. These are just configurations that we did in our own environment, in our labs, just to really try and get a good sample of what typical environments as you move from that small up to that very large environment, some of the rules of thumb, some of the things to think about as you're moving through that, as your hardware changes and things like that. So here we've got a small VM host configuration. All right, as you can see here, we've got the host OS, we have direct access storage, to the both the host and then to each guest, all right? Remember, if these were all, oh, wouldn't be all front ends, there'd be a front end here, maybe not so much an edge, it'd probably be a director, let's say, or a mediation server. You want to plumb direct access storage to each of those guests, all right? They all have SQL, They're all going to know about the users, so you want to have that, give that, so there's no contention issues fighting over the physical drive. Other things to think about is the host, so the VM host, Hyper-V host, has a network adapter directly pumped out of that. And then through, you want to have dedicated network adapters. In this small configuration, you could have, and I've shown here, recommendation is to try and get a dedicated network adapter to each guest VM. Though, you know, you could get away with a small VM host configuration, just say maybe have dual teams, 1 gigabit Ethernet drive, or 10 network adapters, and have that plumbed down to your guests. You could get away with that given some of the characteristics. I'll talk a little bit about that. I see this one, this particular configuration, standard edition. Okay, I see this a lot in standard edition, where I've got everything running on one guest. I may have some other workloads on here as well, and they're sharing that, so that typically I see this in a standard edition. All right, so moving up the scale now, getting into the medium VM host configuration. Typically, I've got 4 to 12 VM hosts here. I've got some existing SAN storage. I've got an iSCSI SAN storage. Here, I'm using DAS for the VM host, Hyper-V host. Typically, I've got multipath I.O., so I've got MPIO running here. I've got some dedicated SCSI channels directly across there. I'm thinking also because of the amount of users I'm going to have in this environment, I'm going to have some type of VLAN configured. I've also got multiple NICs for both one for the host NIC and for each subsequent guest as well. All right, so I'm thinking a little bit more here. You can see the dotted line going across there. I may want to have a dedicated line for each of those disk configurations to the actual guest. Depends on your configuration of your SAN. I find it's a very... it differs from customer to customer how they utilize their SAN storage, but I'm just giving you an example of this particular one. Feel free if you've got any short questions to ask. If you've got longer questions, you can leave that to the end. But
we have giveaways here for the short questions.
Yeah, exactly. We've got some giveaways here. We actually got a phone that's like worth $600. So if you answer, you ask a real gnarly question, all right, you're going to get the good stuff. We don't mess around here in Link. We give you the good stuff. All right. Let's look at the large VM host, 12 to 48. And again, that number can vary depending on you've got some really big iron VM host, you know, some really big ones. Getting into the 64 proc, you're getting into, 128 gig of RAM or even more. You know, I've seen some really big hosts, then they only had three. So it's really up to you on that one. Again, this has got a fiber-connected shared storage. We've got a fiber link here. The more fiber channels that you can get, the better. We're typically getting into this type of configuration, into the, close to the 80,000, like the top-end peak, eight front ends. I'm getting into, into 10,000 thereabouts users per front end. I'm really trying to use all workloads. I'm really getting into the high-end area here. I'm again using the multipath I.O., typically 4 to 8 gigabit channel across that fiber channel there. I'm going to have dedicated lungs again for this. This is pretty, the Hyper-V host is using DAS. Again, I've actually got multiple channels. Typically in this configuration, I'm getting into the 10 gigabit Ethernet. I'm using dual team configuration. I'm starting to get really starting to cater for a large user environment. Yeah, go for it. Like using pass-through or VHD, like a pass-through.
Okay,
No. Yeah. Yeah, like dedicating the VHD or I'm using pass-through. That's a good question. Where's it? I'll put it just here. Reminder, come on, get it. There you go. You got to give it. See? We don't mess around here. You ask good questions.
I think you can catch it.
Get
right?
Some gifts.
There you go.
Good throw. Thank you. Okay, so let's look at the dreaded chart. No, it's not dreaded chart. It just gives you a good idea of what sort of numbers we're looking at here when we look at going from physical to virtualization. And this is probably the most important part to think about. So here I'm just going to show you standard edition. And what I've done is I've broken it up. Firstly, I've got type of role over in the far left-hand corner. Then I'm talking about the features, okay? What modalities am I going to bring up and light up? Then I'll show you from a per-role physical capacity and then a virtual capacity. Show you the CPUs, memory, and then usage, the user, amount of users it can support. So when you look at this chart, you go, Cam, hang on a minute. What are you doing to me here? I got 8-core in the physical, and I'm now going to 4 V-core. What? You cut me in half. What are you doing? You're like chopping me off the legs. The reason for that is that's what Hyper-V supports. That's what Windows 8 Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1, that's what it, Hyper-V, that's what it pushes up to us. We're just going to utilize whatever the host is going to provide to us, and it only supports per guest 4 V cores. Memory isn't a different issue, but for that, remember that because of the nature of Link Server, especially when you've got voice and video, right, it's very CPU bound. Right, we've got the software codec, it's doing its compression, doing its work down onto the CPU. So it is very CPU intensive, so be very careful about that. Because you can look at the numbers. Memory there, I've got 16 gig. Why did I go to the virtualized? What do you think, here's a question, why do you think I've dropped down to around the 12 gig for the IMMP thereabouts? Any ideas? Gentlemen, right up back. That's one thing, definitely. Also, some memory, you've got to give some memory back to the Hyper-V host. Generally, it's like about 2 gig. You've got to give some memory. You can't starve the host. And don't get into oversubscribing. Please, do not get into that. Link does not like that. Link Server 2010 does not like oversubscription and oversubscribing stuff, all right? It gets very, very upset. And also for you VMware users, don't get fancy with all their fancy oversubscription options for the memory and things like that. All right, please. Let's drop down to the bigger one now, Link Server, Enterprise Edition Server, I should say. There's the different features there. You can see the numbers going from the per physical to the virtual. And you know, can see there's a significant... One of the things to look at there is the 8 front-end pool versus a single front-end pool. Obviously, if you go to 8 front-end pool, you're getting about 1,000 more users on the virtual side. Why? Because now you've got 8, it can share, it can distribute the load, and in fact, in some respects, that's our sweet spot for front ends, all right? That's our sweet spot is around, you know, we get around about 10,000 users, or probably less, about 7,500 users per front end, start working out across 8 front ends, you start getting a good sweet spot for your users there, for your capacity.
Campbell, I think we have a short question there.
Yep.
A quick question. I work with a lot of customers who are in the 250 to 500 user range.
Yep. Right. How do you scale it down? Yeah, you could cap at the host layer and just say, here's what I'm going to expose up to the guest. You could cap how many CPUs you want or how many vCores you want to give to that application, to the guest, and starve it that way. In fact, we did that in our labs because we wanted to see and scale it down before things start really getting sluggish and start, you know, underperforming. And we just started capping it. No, we don't. I have seen HP's got a great white paper. Not to say I'm favoring a vendor, I'm just saying. HP's got a really good white paper about the cycles that you use on CPU per so many users. They actually are doing a lot of investigation and work around that because for obvious reasons they want to say if you were running this processor or these processors and you went to this new range, how much more capacity would you get? Now, physical, that really translates well from a virtual point of view because of some of the things that, you know, whatever the host is providing up to us, that's all we can utilize. Answer your question, no, we don't have any specific numbers around that. You could start taking some of these numbers here and sort of halving them and start doing that type of basic arithmetic. That should suffice. That should get you somewhere there. Here's the back end for the SQL Server. The back end here of SQL Server for the front ends and also for the back end. And then I have the various other roles here. And I'll leave that one up there very quickly.
Campbell.
Yes?
Quick question. Just for the purposes for pilots, what's the smallest practical physical server configuration to virtualize as much as possible that we can use for, again, for pilots?
Yeah. How many users are you talking about?
You know,
100? I've seen like 16 gig of RAM, like a RAM size, and... Obviously, you want to get with the processors these days, you can get four vCores straight up into it. That's fine. Direct access storage for that. Obviously, you want to have, if you could get, you know, if it's sort of like a small mid-range server, have, you know, direct access storage for the host, and then maybe, depending on how many guests you've got, have direct access storage for that. Disk is fairly inexpensive and mechanical, of course. You know, I would probably recommend, if they're going to use all modalities, that's the really tricky part, is what are they going to use? Just IMMP? Oh, one NIC, one gig. They're going to have voice and video and conferencing. Whoa, okay, now you may want to have dual, especially for that. I would at least have two physical servers, at least two, just to give me that tolerance of a front end, you know, for the pool level stuff, and then just sort of stripe back and forth from that. I wouldn't get, yeah, if you put it on one, that's your single point of failure. You're toast if it dies. Maybe if your users are tolerable. I find some users in environments aren't tolerable about it. I'll get to your question. There was another lady there. I'll get to your question shortly. I want to get through this where I'm sort of going over time, and he's going to get, sorry? He's a good thrower. I wouldn't know. I'd be like, straight at the back. Conferencing server comparisons here. So maximum conferencing size, physical and virtual. If you're really into conferencing and you're using it a lot, you want to, and you got like a, remember we've got a new limit, not limitation, we've got a new limit, if you like, of 1,000 users, you may want to have a dedicated physical conference pool if you're going into that extent. All right. If not, you're at 125 for virtualized, 250 for physical. Standalone AV conferencing, physical and virtual here, 10 and 5 respectively. See those details. Again, this I've talked a lot about this, so I'll move through this pretty quickly. This is, again, if I had a virtual enterprise deployment, let's say I had 40,000 users. A default user profile means there's a certain percentage around. I'd have 7% is my audio and video. I'd have like 3% that's doing conferencing. The rest are doing IMMP. That's sort of like our way of calculating. If you use the capacity planning tool, it gives you that default profile characteristics. I've stuck my edge guests on a host here. I may not want to have it on one physical host. I may want to have another physical host there and spread it. They're non-domain joined. All right, they're doing their thing for the DMZ. Notice I separated that away. Then I've tried to sort of mix across and stripe across the host. The dark blue lines on the outer side of the physical host, and then the inner ones you're seeing guests. We have front ends, I have AV, I have my directors, I have my SQL back end, I have monitoring and archiving running there. You can see that. This is running 64 gigabytes of RAM for each of the dark blue lines with about 16 core in. Tried to give you some idea. Going into a smaller 20,000 users, again, default user profile. You can see now that I'm scaling back on the number of hosts, physical hosts, and then I'm also striving to try and give me that fault tolerance. Notice that I've moved my edge. I've got an edge now that's sitting in here. I may want it. What you could do, and I've talked to some people about this, and obviously you want to test it, is have my edge on a dedicated VLAN and just have that coming in and then do a virtual network adapter across to maybe my first front end or something like that. So you can utilize some of the capabilities there of the virtualization. Here's really where I've got mixed environment. So I've got physical and I've got virtual. Physical server here, my file store, my SQL, obviously here is actually physical, maybe because I'm running other applications on here that need SQL Server. Then I've got a branch site as well, and I may want to have that and virtualized, and then I have my regular data center site here with striped pools. Last one is the standard edition, 2,000 users. Again, we were using the same hardware similar to what we were using for the other environments. Give you that it's fairly small. Everything's self-contained in standard edition. I don't have to worry about that's the difference by going from standard to enterprise. I can start using larger pool configurations. Standard edition, I don't get that. So generally what happens is that you federate the two, and then slowly ciphering users across that. I find that there are some. They want to have all of the capabilities at a branch office, so they decide not to go in a branch office configuration. They actually put standard edition. I've had customers where they just federate and just have standard running everywhere, and they don't use their enterprise for anything. It's really up to you. Performance guideline, make sure you've got VMQ. I've talked about this on supported adapters. Ensure that you have the latest network adapter driver installed. That's a big one. You may want to increase your packet receive buffers to 1024. Here's some performance counters. Some of these are fairly straightforward. This first three is pretty much your pretty standard things to think about. When you get down into databases and SIP, look at some of the SIP responses. That is it keeping up? Are your front ends keeping up with capacity there? You can see there some of the local responding and sends outstanding. It's not keeping up. You may have, in fact, limited the gentleman talking about a pilot. I've limited the number of front-end guests, and now it's having a hard time keeping up. You're going to start seeing a lot of SIP traffic that's starting to build up. You also, if your back-end is virtualized and you're not getting enough throughput on your back-end, you'll start seeing, in fact, certainly the queue latency and SPROC latency, you'll start seeing that build up significantly. All right? So start thinking about what are my options here. I may want to go physical for my back-end. You can do mixed and support it. I want to keep stressing that, supported. All right, I'll now hand it over to Tarek.
Thank you. Great job, excellent job on the coverage of server virtualization. Thank you very much.
No problem.
So I'll just stand over here. So in my portion of this session, I'll be covering the client virtualization white paper topics. Point of disclaimer, if you've read that, have no questions, this might not be the best use of your time. If you have any questions about it, feel free to ask the big ones near the end, because I do want to get to a virtualization demo. And I will be presenting some topics here, and we'll be asking a question near the end with a big prize here for an IP phone, $600 value phone. And yeah, that big box right over there. So we'll be covering different supported configurations for VDI, virtualized desktops, and we'll be covering also some of the limitations currently with Link 2010 in a virtualized environment. So before we start, let's just get on the same page on what is virtualization, what is VDI specifically, and why do customers use that, and what's the benefits. So virtualization of desktops is basically moving your desktops into your data center, making that accessible to your employee base through a remote protocol. It could be RDP, ICA, PCOIP, some protocol to access that desktop that's being virtualized in the data center. And customers typically do this for three classes of benefits. There are quantifiable benefits like reduction in cost, because these thin clients that they use to access their desktops are usually cheaper than a full-fledged desktop. And they also require less storage, so you're not spending too much money on storage. And overall, there's less operational costs. It's cheaper to maintain these thin clients. There's also organizational benefits. Basically, you're allowing your employee base to access from different set of devices. So you hear of the concept BYOD, bring your own device. This is becoming more prevalent in different organizations, where they allow customers, employees to come in with their iPad, with their Linux box, with their iMac for working from home, and access that virtual machine. And so you allow that flexibility, but you still maintain the security. And that's in the functional benefits. You maintain that security of that of your enterprise, and you separate the enterprise data from the customer's data. Customer may have their private pictures on their desktops and their work stuff in the VM. Everything's secured and backed up in the VM, while as you don't have to manage the endpoint or the customer access device. VDI is being adopted greatly in different market segments. Financial segments is pretty ahead of the curve in the public sector as well, as you can see from this graph. It's a bit outdated, but we still see the finance sector always on the cutting edge of virtualization. I know one financial customer that has close to 99% of their employees accessing a virtualized desktop. This is basic architecture of a VDI setup here. You have on the right, you have the servers in your data centers, and on the left you have your remote desktop clients. Typically you have the VMs hosted on your server, and you have your operational software and your collaboration software in your VM, like PowerPoint, Link, and any other productivity software in there. Everything is running inside the VM. And you have a light, thin client over there, or could be a desktop that accesses the virtual machine via one of these protocols. Could be others, too. Now, if you start using Link and launching Link inside the virtual machine, that's where it gets interesting, because Link does a lot of encoding and decoding of video streams and audio streams. So if you run that over there and you encode and decode on the server with thousands of users, you're hitting the server. You're impacting it because these operations are compute intensive and resource intensive. But let's say you have a low low number of employees, not large enough, and you're saying you have a very powerful server that can handle that load. Let's say you're in that situation. Well, you're also impacting the bandwidth over your network. You might not have that much of a capacity to handle audio and video streams that are going over this wire. Plus, that protocol that is running over here, RDP, for example, is not optimized for audio and video. These protocols were developed for mouse moves and Windows refreshes. So the protocol itself doesn't handle it very well. And finally, you don't get all the quality of service that you expect on thin clients because, for example, E911, if a customer makes a call, their location is actually in the data center. You want the user when he's on the go making a 911 call, that call identifies that person's location and not sends the authorities to the data center. So you're not getting all the expected experiences and the value of Link in this setup. But we do have a supported configuration that addresses some of these issues, and actually all of them. And here's a typical configuration that we support, and it's captured in the white paper. The white paper does not have this diagram, so this should helpfully clarify it a bit. On the right here, you have the user accessing their virtual machine from their desktop. In this case, I'm using a Windows embedded device, and I'm running a remote desktop viewer on my machine. And on the far end, I have my Windows 2008 R2 SP1 server hosting my desktop, and the Link client A is logged on and runs Link in that VM. That Link client needs to connect to the Link server, so there's that connection for signaling is established once the user logs on. Another user may be in a similar situation because I show you here user A/B. So user B has the same setup, and he has his separate VM, separate Link running in, and they're paired up with the Link server, and they can actually start IM presence and app sharing within the VM. There's no problem there in load. We don't have these three problems that I shared initially. Any one of these users, they can, of course, call a Link user who's not running in a virtualized environment that will run the Link client locally and just on their desktop, and that's also possible. So you can have all these IM and presence and app sharing between these three users. But it gets interesting when you start adding audio. For that, the supported configuration is to have a USB IP phone. So it's an IP phone with USB remoting. You tether that phone to your thin client or access device via USB. And then you establish your audio in and out with the target cold party. Notice here there's no video support. So video is not supported today in a virtualized environment. Here you see the audio. Again, it's very important to note that the audio does not go over the connection between the end user and the server. So you've offloaded that processing on the server, you've offloaded the network, and you get all the quality of service you expect because the user does a 911 connect call, for example, they get the location of that phone because that's a SIP endpoint. Okay, make sense? So there's, again, I want to stress the fact that USB remoting is required for this. If you're running a protocol that does not enable USB remoting, then this is not supported. Do you have a question? Right, so you're saying Link A is calling Link B, and both are virtualized. Yeah, so both will have a phone, and you'll, the phone will send the audio.
Yeah, but I'm talking about Link C.
Yeah? Link C will have their own soft clients.
External.
Sorry?
External. If it's an external
user, if it's an external user, then your connection, the Link server is connected to a, through a gateway to a PSTN, and that connection comes down from the Link server down to your endpoint. And also, you can do conferencing because you have the MCU, so the phone will connect to the MCU. So the key point to note here is that audio does not happen over your remote connection, and it has to have has to happen peer to peer, has to happen to the endpoint receiving it. That's the key point. So again, with the USB redirection, of course, you need to use a phone that has a Link 2010 phone edition running on it because that's a SIP endpoint. And we have a list of qualified phones that I can show you later on our Link UC open interoperability page. We go through a rigorous qualification process, and devices that are qualified are listed up there. So I have a question now for you guys. See who's paying attention. Which one of these functionalities is enabled and in a virtualized setup? Which ones are enabled, which ones are disabled or are not recommended? We said no video. Yeah. Sir, you already got a prize. Same one. We said no video. What else?
No recording.
Good. And no, actually, you can desktop share. So here's a summary. You can have all this presence, instant messaging, desktop sharing, application sharing, PowerPoint sharing, whiteboards. All that is available because that's, again, Windows refreshes, mouse moves. File transfer as well. Audio is limited because we said it's only with a USB-enabled IP phone with USB remoting. Video is not, and recording is not. Whoever said that recording? Recording
I'll,
over there, so
I'll
maybe
it,
maybe later, or you can get it. Here you go.
I got one.
Okay.
Thanks, bud. No problem.
So let's just summarize also what kinds of protocols enable this USB remoting. If we run, and this is called out in the white paper, if you run Citrix Zen Desktop 4.0 with Hyper-V, then we support audio in that configuration. So, we'll show you a demo with this, and I'll go deeper into the kind of configuration and setup for this. How about remote desktop services, remote effects, Citrix HGX, enabling flash redirection? Is that supported by Microsoft? That's a question. No, that audio in these configurations is not supported by Microsoft. So the limitations here and why it's not supported is we covered one of them because the protocol that connects the thin client to your end, to your server is not meant for real-time audio and real-time video. It wasn't built for that. So that's one of the reasons why you have that limitation. Another is protocol improvements and like Citrix HDX and the remote FX. These have not been tested by Microsoft. So we don't, for Microsoft, the term supported means we've tested it, it met all our criteria, and we know if there are any bugs or known issues. And we've tried to address them or we're addressing them. So that's what it means by supported. For us, as Citrix HDX or remote FX are not supported because we have not tested in a VDI setup. Also, the flash redirection is another one. We covered this, but I want to call it out as a rule of thumb. To deliver enterprise-grade audio for Link, audio must be peer-to-peer. And we discussed that with you, that it has to initiate and terminate from the endpoint, not go through the server. You're adding an extra hop, you're adding delay, and you're killing your server and your network. That's rule of thumb number one. Well, some people say, well, you're not giving me much options here. I'm only limited to Hyper-V with Citrix 4.0. What about other configurations? Can third parties make their own statements? The answer is yes, they can. And this is a quote from the white paper. Third-party vendors may support configurations not supported by Microsoft. But in that case, you need to reach out to that party making that claim. For example, Citrix has announced the link on Zen Desktop 5.x is supported. This is their link. This is their article. That's fine. They can support that. They'll support the customer calls. But third-party, in general, third-party support statements are not supported by Microsoft. And we recommend that you reach out to the licensing guy to see if you're using a valid configuration and contact your account team for cost-related questions. Mentioned one rule of thumb, which was audio has to be peer-to-peer. Second rule of thumb is when you're in doubt of a particular configuration, whether or not it's supported by Microsoft, consult the white paper. And there's also, I'll add for you a link later so you can reach out to, with questions as well. Some people want to know if a link can be run natively on your Windows embedded thin client. The answer is no, that's not supported. The only supported models is application remoting, application streaming, or full desktop remoting. Full desktop remoting is what we've been talking about, VDI, basically. And application remoting is when your application is running in the server and you're just getting the bit refreshes. Well, application streaming is the bits of the application come and run on your endpoint. So you have all the link functionalities supported with application streaming, but not with the application remoting. Okay, so this is a configuration that we have in our labs that you can use as a proof of concept, and actually we'll be demoing it today. I've demoed this before where I had the two thin clients, actually two machines that are talking to each other on the podium here, but that causes interference and feedback. So one of the, so I start off here with two laptops. One of them is over here, and the other one is in the link booth downstairs, and both are running the Citrix Online plugin. Both are connected to the internet, local area network here, and reach out to our access gateway. But we also have our phones. Like I said, these are IP phones, so they're also connected to the network. So I have two phones and two laptops. Here I have only one of the phones and one of the laptops, and they are USB connected. And I have my test lab. This is back in Redmond. In there I have a Hyper-V farm where it could be a Zen server or ESX Sphere server, but in my case, I'm using a Hyper-V farm with a bunch of virtual desktops. One here is a Citrix Zen Desktop 4.0 desktop delivery controller and the licensing server, both together in one VM. Another is, there's also a bunch of prerequisites that you need to enable and install as part of that VM, and they're listed here, like SQL Express, .NET, IIS, I'm not going into detail on the prerequisites going forward, but there might be a bunch of prerequisites. But the main role of this VM is Zen Desktop 4.0 DDC and license server. You also have an Active Directory domain controller and a System Center virtual machine manager. Then I have also a bunch of virtual machines. Each one has its VDA, a virtual desktop agent. So that's my Hyper-V farm. I also need a provisioning server, if you're familiar with the PVS. In the white paper, actually, we cover PVS version 5.1, yet I'm using here 5.6 because I'm trying to prove a concept to you that just that it's not supported doesn't mean it doesn't work. You need to differentiate between the two. Something may work, but it's not supported because it has not been tested yet by Microsoft. And in this case, the white paper says PVS 5.1. I'm using 5.6. But if I have a customer, if I have an issue, then the first, and I reach out to Microsoft, the first thing I'll say is make sure you're using one of the supported configurations. We've tested that. We haven't tested 5.6. So both of these environments are running Windows Server 2008 R2 as their basic operating system. And here I have a bunch of virtual disks hosted in this PVS. Virtual disk 1, 2, and 3. I also have the Link Server Client EE environment. So it's a standalone standard edition Link server setup. However, because I need because of the setup and connection here from TechEd, I couldn't use that setup, and I'm logging into actually the corporate account. So because this Link server is not connected to an Edge or Access Gateway, so I'm not able to log on from TechEd. That's why you can replace Link server client E environment with the actual Link topology that we have the corporate Link account. And we have a bunch of front-end servers, a couple of front-end servers in our client EE, but like I said, I'm not really using that in this demo today. Of course, we have the back, the regular test lab infrastructure, DHCP, and domain name services. So let me just walk you through here. How are we doing in time?
We've got 30 minutes. Good. Good.
So I would walk you through the launch of the setup here. First of all, these VMs, when they get started, they pixie boot and look for a for the provisioning server, and they reach the virtual disks. As you can see here, a couple of VMs are sharing the same vDisk. Then after they load up, they can they do a DDC lookup for the Active Directory, and they get the pointer to that DDC, and they register to that DDC. Once that happens, and your backend is all up and running, the virtual machines are ready, the user can start their Zen Desktop environment or client, in this case, Citrix Receiver, or the online web plugin. I'm actually using a web plugin. And they request a virtual machine from the DDC, and the DDC returns them the connection information, and the VM is launched. So now the user has a VM, and they launch Link within that VM. That Link client establishes a connection to the front-end server and logs in. With USB remoting enabled, your presence information also appears on your phone. And we'll see that also. So you have this pairing between your client in the VM and your phone. If I change my status in my VM, it changes on the phone. I can do my IM and collaboration and presence with another party, like we said, who may be virtualized. In this case, it is. May not be virtualized as well, so I can reach any of the user base. And like we said, once we establish audio, the audio happens peer-to-peer. It does not have to go through all this setup and goes all the way to your Link server and back. So you're having an optimum bypassed connection for your audio while signaling remains going back to your server. These slides will be available for download, so feel free to download it after the session. Also, this is being recorded, so you can also download that. So, rule of thumb number 3, and we did cover that, just because a particular configuration works doesn't mean it's supported by Microsoft. This configuration works for me, PVS 5.6, it's not supported. If I'm using a 5.1, it will be supported. Okay, question? No, these are, good question. So let me repeat the question. Do we have portable IP phones? So yes, here, for example, I'm using a phone that's portable. Let me just share, do a sharing here and see if we can show you the phone. Here we go. So this is an Acer 6725. Let me zoom up a bit. I don't know. It's okay. So it's not very clear. Can you help us for the presence information? Isn't really clear, is it? No?
Turn on focus.
Yeah.
It's a little bit dark.
That's okay. Well, I wanted to show you the information in the screen here, but we're having some clarification. Okay, we'll tilt
we
it.
Go.
Okay. Can we also zoom it up? Because I need to get more. Yeah.
There we go.
Okay.
I can do that.
That's great. Thank you. That's much better. And you can tilt it.
Highest
thank
paid
you.
Tilter.
Maybe. Yeah. So, pardon me? Yeah, it's over here. But there's a bunch of phones. You can see it. It's small. Some of these are Power over Ethernet, PoE. This one is a PoE phone. And the one that I'm going to be giving away today is also PoE. So it's you can carry that along, but we yeah, go ahead.
When you're referring to that USB enabled, are you talking about that tethered?
Yes.
Configuration?
Yes, better together configuration. Yeah. So let me show you here my virtual machine. I'm logged in. Here's my desktop. And here's my virtual machine. So this is through Cetric Zen Desktop. And like I said, I am connected to Redmond. So that's why the refresh rate may be a bit slow. And I'm logged in here through Link. And it's USB connected, because it's USB connected, once I log on to my client, I can log on to the phone as well. So, because I don't have, this is an extended desktop, here's David, Paul, and I can IM him here. Hello, Paul. He's down in the booth.
He may be getting questions.
Yeah, I hope not.
Good questions. Good questions from you guys.
Okay, so sometimes this happens when he's not looking at his desktop, but the IMs are going. So let me just call him and show you what happens when I escalate to a call. So as you can see, it calls it paired from the phone and called from the phone. Calling Paul. Connected.
Oh, he's gone busy.
Hello, Paul.
He's going to talk to us.
Paul, are you on mute?
He's ignoring you. The do not disturb will come up next.
Let's switch back.
Sure.
Okay, so please call me, man.
This sounds familiar in your own environments, doesn't it?
No, it's actually connected, but I can't hear him.
Next, we'll have to go to Windows Phone and talk to him on the Windows
Phone. Okay, so how about this? And let me share the desk, do something here. Call me at this number, please, and you'll be part of the demo.
There we go.
Okay. That's Paul still. Oh, well.
Now he's
answering. Okay, now he's answering.
Now he wants to do this.
Okay, so Paul. Can't hear him. Speakerphone. Everybody is now calling me. Okay, let me close this and answer somebody. Let's see. I can't see very well. Is this an answer? Accept. Okay. Accept the call.
All right, talk away now. Now they're going to be quiet.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello?
How you doing?
Hi, where is he? Raise your hand. Thank you. So there you go. He's calling me through my through the PSTN and reaching me over my VM connection. All right? So I don't know why Paul has some audio issues.
He's a consultant. He's been.
So let's try here again, maybe with Paul, and escalate to a video.
And you like that?
Let me walk you through also the connection of
a
video connection. So over here I have got my webcam, and I want to walk you through the connection of the webcam and making it available in my virtual machine. Hey. Okay. So Paul is already connected and ready with with his webcam, and I want to start a web conversation with him. So first of all, the device appears on my local desktop here. And where's my mouse? There we go. I'll go to, remember the USB remote thing that we were talking about?
Looks like it's connected.
That's the Astrophone USB remoted.
And right now installing the driver for the webcam. Device is ready.
It's already there. Unknown device.
Yep. So the webcam needs to appear here so that I can enable USB remoting. But right now it's not. Yeah. Pardon me? It's not supported. I just wanted to show you what happens if I escalate the video.
You don't see that?
Yeah. So if you, so here's the thing. If you escalate to a video, once this becomes available and I share it and I make it available in my VDI session, both the audio and video connections start going, rather than going peer-to-peer, they start going into my remote desktop connection. So both audio and video degrade. So I have now here the prize for the person who can list for me the three rules of thumb that we mentioned. And if you know them, you can come up to the stage here. We have two people volunteering.
Uh-oh.
The rules of thumb.
Rules of thumb. There's three of them.
Okay. Do we have a third person volunteering for the three rules of thumb? Okay. You can mention one.
Audio is point-to-point only.
Audio is point-to-point only. Second rule of thumb?
When in doubt, use VDI supported by Microsoft.
When in doubt, use the or confirm, check the white paper to see which configurations are supported by Microsoft. And the third one is?
If it is logging, doesn't mean that Microsoft is supported.
Right. So rock, paper, scissors. Or maybe we... or maybe better, rock, paper, Azure, right? There you go. Go ahead. Arm wrestle for it.
Rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah, go ahead. Scissors. Okay, you're out. No, between you two. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. One more.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. You crushed him. Congratulations.
Good job.
Okay, thank you very much. If you have any questions, feel free to bring him up to the stage here, and we'll try and address your concerns.
Just want to close here. So here you saw the Link Server 2010 virtualized environment, how to configure it, supporting VDI configurations for Link 2010 client. And then you saw the limitation client-server virtualization configurations. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And you can ask Campbell how you can configure that.
Some sessions that have already happened, certainly look at them and review them. Also, there's a technical learning center on the VDI desktop infrastructure. White papers, definitely go and get them.
Yes. You can expect more coverage and more.
I think that's it, the team log.